Welcome, everyone. This is the fifth lecture of the Mises Academy course, Money, Monopoly, and Market Intervention, which we're having in the, now it's November of 2011. And tonight, we're finishing up the third of Chapter 11 of Man, Economy, and State. And this, I've been eager to get to this, in all honesty, since we started going through with these Mises Academy classes, going through Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. I've been impatient to get to this part of the book because this is really the stuff we're going to do at the end of tonight's lecture. I don't know. I don't know if I would say it's my favorite part of the whole book, but it's up there. And it was really when I was younger and reading this for the first time and hit that stuff, like it really, I was like, finally, somebody crystallized what's wrong with this crazy Keynesian system and, you know, put his finger on it and just blew it up. And I always knew something was screwy with it, but I couldn't really, I never took 20 minutes to just sit down and walk through it, and this guy Rothbard just did it. This is great. So we'll make sure I leave enough time at the end to go through that carefully. Okay, but first of all, let's talk about this famous equation of exchange. Especially if you've been following my exploits on my blog, my personal blog, which, hey, why don't I give a plug for that in case you don't know. It's called Free Advice. So if you Google Bob Murphy Free Advice, it'll be one of the top hits. And anyway, I've been going back and forth there with this guy, Scott Sumner. And something that comes up a lot with people who talk about monetary policy and worry about, is the Fed providing enough liquidity and that sort of thing. One of the standard tools that these macroeconomists use is called the equation of exchange. So let's be clear on what it is. First of all, let's make a distinction. The equation of exchange, and I've listed two of its most popular forms here for you on this slide, the MV equals PT, or it's sometimes written MV equals PQ, and in a second I'll explain that distinction. But let me just say one thing up front. A lot of times people will use the equation of exchange and refer to it as the quantity theory of money. And those are different things. All right, so I'm not going to test you on this, but this is just a bit of background context for you. Just be careful here that those are distinct things. So you can illustrate, and people do choose to do this, you can illustrate the so-called quantity theory of money using the equation of exchange, and that's because economists have done that, particularly Milton Friedman. I think that's why most economists nowadays almost think these two things are interchangeable. But strictly speaking, let me just give you an example. You could say the equation of exchange is true because of the tautology. It's just, and Rothbard even says this, that it's once you know what the terms mean, if you are okay and concede for the sake of argument that those terms are meaningful, well, then the equation's true. It's not like one economist could think this equation's true and somebody else could disagree. If you stipulate, like I say, for the sake of argument that these four variables are meaningfully defined, well, then, of course, the equality has to be true, which is it's an accounting identity. It's a tautology. But what economists mean by the quantity theory of money, that is a theory. So some economists believe in it, or rather, some economists believe in certain versions of it, whereas other economists might think that, nah, that's really not, that's misleading, or, you don't want to think like that. That's not the way to approach macro issues. All right, so, like I say, a lot of times people conflate the two. For our purposes tonight, I'm not even going to tell you, well, gee, what is the quantity theory of money? Because there's different versions of it. So we're not even going to go down that road. I just want you to be careful. This equation of exchange is distinct from the quantity theory of money, even though nowadays if you ever see anybody talking about the quantity theory of money, 99% chance they're going to use the equation of exchange to show you what they're talking about. Okay, so equation of exchange, now we're just going to focus on that. Like I say, Rothbard talks about it in this form, MV equals PT. However, the way I learned it and the way you might see it used nowadays, if economists use it, is MV equals PQ. So what what's the difference? I think I may have already talked about this. This sounds familiar to me now that I'm saying this, so maybe I mentioned this in an earlier class, but repetition won't hurt. So M obviously is the stock of money. Another little quibble here. I may slip and say supply of money, but strictly speaking, you want to be careful because supply means the supply schedule. It means the various possible purchasing powers of money and what quantities would the producers of money bring forth to market at those various hypothetical purchasing powers. Just like the supply of oranges is not a number. It's not, you can't say, hey, what's the supply of oranges? And someone says, oh, it's 3,247 oranges. That, no, you say, well, the supply of oranges means list all the various hypothetical prices of an orange quoted in dollars or whatever, and then what quantity would orange producers bring to market at those various prices. So, again, just to be for the sake of purism, I'm going to try to be good, and whenever I'm talking about M here, say the stock of money, meaning at any given moment, what is the actual quantity in existence of units of money? So ounces of gold, if we're talking about an economy that uses gold as its money, or dollars held by the public and in the checking system, if that's are the definitions of M1, if we're talking about the U.S. right now, so on. Okay, so that's what M is. V is the velocity of circulation. And so just think of it as during the time period in question, how often on average does a given unit of money turn over? How often does it change hands? How often is it used in a transaction? P is the price level, meaning what's the average price of all the goods in the economy, so all the things for which money is exchanged on any given transaction, you can tell what's the price, what's the money price of that particular good at that moment. So P is just the average of that figure across all goods. And then in this top equation, the T, that stands for the total number of transactions that are occurring. Now, so let's back up. So why is this true? Why is MV equals PT? Why is it true? Because this left side, just think about it, that's saying the total stock of money multiplied by the average number of times that a unit of money turns hands, changes hands, turns over in the time period that we're considering. So multiply those two together, what do you get? That gives you the total number of money units that changed hands in the time period under consideration. So in other words, that's how much total money was spent. And then over here, P is the average price per transaction, and T is the average number of or the total number of transactions, I should say. So P times T is the total revenue that was received. So we're just saying the total amount of money spent equals the total amount of money received. And anytime somebody spends money, there's a counterparty that's receiving money. So this is clearly a true equation. It's an identity. All right, it's not a theory. So, all right, so that top line's fine. Now, the bottom line, though, this is less obvious. The MV and the P mean the same thing, of course. But this Q, what people mean by that, what economists mean by that, is real output. So that's like real GDP. That's like, you know, oh, how much actual stuff is the economy making for people, as opposed to how many dollar bills are floating around. No, like how many cars are there, how many apples and oranges, and what's the quantity of real output. All right, so that's what the Q stands for. So now here, it's not as obvious that this bottom equation is true, because you got to be careful about what, like I said, what modern economists mean by this Q is something like real GDP. But as you know, if you've had to take a course in standard macro or if you've ever gone through the agony of an exposition talking about the construction of GDP and what's in it and what's not, GDP means final goods and services produced in a given period. And for those of you who are with us, was it the, I don't remember if it was the first Academy class or the second one going through Rothbard, but I think probably the second one. But remember, GDP famously nets out the so-called, the gross investment at the various stages. So the, you know, the farmer sells the wheat for $10, and then the miller sells the flour for $15, and then when the miller sells the flour for $15 to the baker, that, I mean, up here, that's $15 that changed hands. In terms of the total expenditures in that period of time for doing a year in that year, that counted as $15, right? The baker needed to have $15 to give to the miller, and the price of that flour was $15 per whatever the unit we're using here. So this is still true up here, but the M and the V have to include, you know, they have to be gross figures. Whereas down, you know, when we're doing real GDP, we don't count that, you know, that transaction did not add $15 to nominal GDP. So just be clear, we're not even talking here about the distinction between nominal and real. We're talking about the definition of GDP. So when the miller, when the baker spends $15 buying flour from the miller, that's not $15 contributing to GDP. It's only counting it as five because we're netting out the 10 that the miller had to pay for the wheat to the farmer, right? We don't want to double count. We don't want to count it as 10 plus 15 is 25 so far in GDP, because when all is said and done, you know, it's just going to be, we're going to add up the bread, and then the bread, you know, the amount of bread that initial bundle of wheat ends up generating, we can just count the bread as the final goods and services that the consumer gets, or we can sum up the value added at each stage. But what we can't do is say, oh, $10 of wheat was produced, $15 of flour was produced, whatever, you know, $30 of bread at the wholesale level was produced, and then $50 of bread at the retail was produced, and add up all those numbers and say, oh, wow, we have a booming account. No, they would just look at either the final bread or they do the value added at each stage. Okay, so what I'm saying here is this, you strictly speaking, I actually misspoke before when I said that this V is the same and this M is the same. Well, the M's got to be the same, but if you really want to do it correctly, I mean, the V, I think you'd have to say, is the velocity for use in final transactions, because, again, you're actually not trying to measure the total amount of expenditures. And that actually, for those of you who are geeky enough and follow these things, those people who want to target nominal GDP, they actually speak very sloppily, use an adverb. And when I debate that guy, Scott, this might be too geeky to get into, but he likes to call it, oh, we're just focusing on total spending. And no, he's not, because GDP is not total spending. GDP is net spending per state. And it's weird because the G in gross domestic product is just for gross, but it's GDP is not capturing gross expenditures. So anyway, I just want to point out, so nowadays economists tend to use the equation of exchange thinking MV equals PQ, and so how was it used? Let me just make sure you get the context here, give you the big picture instead of these little nitty-gritty quibbles I have. The idea is they want to say something like this. They want to say, okay, look at this equation. So if the Fed increases the money supply, so here M goes up on the left side, and let's say M doubles, what do we know has to happen? Well, if V just gets cut in half, well, then it's perfectly offset, and there's no reason for anything over here to be changed. But if M goes up and doubles and V stays the same, well, then that means this whole left side doubles. So that means the right side has to double. So what can happen? And I say, well, if we're already at full capacity, then P just might double. So we don't have any more real goods and services. It's not like we're actually producing more stuff for people. It's just that on average, the price level is twice as high. Okay, so that would be a case where money has no real effects. You double the money supply, and all that happens is the price tag on everything gets multiplied by two, but all the underlying real activity is the same. So the standard of living is the same, unemployment is the same, blah, blah, blah. But you could say, if we're in a liquidity trap or whatever, we have high unemployment, and right now in this special environment, if you increase M, and again, if velocity doesn't totally offset it, then what might happen is just from the equation that this right side has to go up, but maybe if P just goes up a little bit because there's all this excess slack in the economy and, wages can't go up, and so competition is going to keep product prices down. So what happens is Q fills the gap. So Q has to go up. And that's what we want, because we want to increase real output. All right, so that's, or a different, another way that Keynesians might use this, and Brad DeLong talked like this for a while at least, is they say, when we're in a liquidity trap, and, and so when they're trying to explain why is it that Bernanke's apparently very loose monetary policies of the past few years, how come we still, we have damp inflation, price inflation, and we still have high unemployment, what's the deal? They're going to say, it's because we're in a liquidity trap and interest rates are rock bottom levels. When the interest rate is zero, money and bonds are interchangeable, or at least government bonds that are considered real safe. And so they're going to say, what happens in this strange environment when Bernanke comes in and announces that the Fed's going to buy $1 trillion worth of treasuries, that doesn't do anything. It's like what the old Keynesian said, with the Fed would be pushing on a string, because they're saying that, the government or the Fed creates $1 trillion in new base money, gives it over to the banks, and then takes $1 trillion worth of treasuries from them. So from the bank's point of view, before they had an asset that was basically guaranteed by the government, that was considered perfectly safe, that if you have a treasury, it says that Uncle Sam's going to give you $1,000 next year, you're pretty sure you're going to get $1,000 next year. But if it pays 0% interest, okay, that's all you're getting. Or what if the Fed takes that from you and actually gives you a $1,000 bill or $1,000 bills or reserves on deposit with the Fed that if you want to, you can withdraw and get paper currency? They're going to say, economically, from the bank's point of view, those are almost at this point indistinguishable assets, whether you had a $1,000 treasury bond or $1,000 in cash. What's the difference if the interest rate's zero? Normally, if the interest rate's 5%, well, then there is a difference there. But right now they're saying cash and treasuries are virtually indistinguishable. So when the Fed greatly increased the quantity of base money, what happened? They said V just proportionally offset it. That now all of a sudden the banks are sitting on twice as much cash, but that's not going to affect their desire to go buy stuff or to lend money or whatever, because before they just would have been sitting on the bonds, so now they're just going to sit on that much more cash. So if you use the concept, the definition of V, then you're just going to say, well, now V just got cut in half. All right, so let me say that again. Some Keynesians would use the equation of exchange to illustrate the impotence of temporary injections of money, if it doesn't change people's long-term forecasts about prices and stuff like that, by saying, you could try doubling M, but in the present environment, that means V would just get cut in half. So M times V would be the same, and you'd see nothing happen over here. So that's why Bernanke was able to jack up M really high, and we didn't see prices go up very much, and we didn't see output go up very much, because what happened is V just moved to offset it. All right, so that's the kind of way that mainstream economists use that. Milton Friedman, he had very nuanced views and everything, but I think it's fair to say his big picture, statement that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, the way he would justify that would be to look at something like this and say, in the long term, over a long period of time, if M is going up really high, then as long as V doesn't plummet and Y, then you're going to have rising prices. And then the long, especially too, if you think in the long run, printing money can't increase output, then you're going to have something like that. So that's kind of thing that can happen, or that's kind of way that mainstream economists might use this. So Robert has a bunch of objections. Hang on, let me just jump ahead here. Okay. I knew I had a second slide. I just want to remember what I said there. Okay. So Robert has a bunch of objections. Let me just run through some of the main problems he's got. So one thing is, he's saying, look, this is just, yeah, it's true, but it's an identity, just the definitions of these variables. And he goes through and lists other true equations that are clearly economically meaningless. And Rothbard's point is, the reason we attribute causality to these things, that we say, oh, what happens if M goes up? What does that do to V? Or what does that do to P? Or what does that do to T? That really, that's because we're relying on some economic theory. And so the story we tell for how this equation is going to remain in balance if one of the variables changes sounds plausible to us, but we don't, but we're wrong if we're looking at this equation and thinking the equation's giving us that information. So let's not fool ourselves. This equation is not a theory of how these things interact with each other in the economy. You would need to have that independently. And so Rothbard's, one of his points is just, this equation is not giving you anything. All it's doing is misleading you to think about the economy in a bad way. And so if you already have this outside theory for how increases in the quantity of money might affect prices or real output or whatever, then just use that. You're not doing yourself any favors by then translating it into these four clumsy variables and then slapping an equation sign in the middle of it and thinking you're doing science. So part of why Rothbard hates this thing is he says just methodologically, look at what we're doing here. We are not explaining market phenomena by reference to individual preferences and what motivates people and their individual actions and then sort of summing that up and coming up with market outcomes that can ultimately be traced back to subjective individual valuations and actions, which is what Rothbard thinks the proper role of the economist is. So remember, if Rothbard wants to talk about what's the market price of potatoes, well, he can, like any other economist, say, oh, it's because of supply and demand, but you keep pushing him, and he would ultimately trace it back to individual value scales and people ranking different quantities of money against different units of potatoes, either the potatoes they had if they're farmers or potatoes they're thinking about acquiring if they're consumers or if they're restaurants that need to make mashed potatoes and I got to go buy a bunch of potatoes. So, but you wouldn't, if you want to talk about how do you explain the price of potatoes, you wouldn't say, okay, what's the total quantity of potatoes in the economy? How often on average do potatoes change hands? And then what's the average price of a potato times the number of transactions involving potatoes? Right? I mean, you see, I mean, it's even hard for me to set up the analogy there because it was just so silly as I was going through it. I mean, just think about it. Wasn't it clear as I just walked through that? Again, let me just say that again. Let's say I'm trying to explain the price of potatoes. How do we normally do it? Supply and demand schedules, and then you can push the explanation back as far as you want until you ultimately get to the point that you have individuals with subjective value scales on which they've got various units of potatoes against, you know, every other possible good in the economy. So that's as far back as we can push it using subjective marginal utility theory. Or we could do this sort of macro holistic approach and say, oh, you want to explain the price of potatoes? Okay, well, let's write out an equation and say, tell me the total quantity of potatoes, tell me how often during the period in question an average potato changes hands, then tell me the price of potatoes, and then tell me per transaction, and then tell me how many transactions involve potatoes. And now, if we make some assumptions about how those variables move with respect to each other, I have just explained for you why the price of potatoes is what it is. And you can see that that's crazy. Another way of putting it is to say, if we rearrange this equation up here, we could write P equals MV divided by T. But then if you inquired as to what are the constituents of those, of that expression, the M, the V, and the T, you would see that they are, certainly at the aggregate level, they're actually almost meaningless. That it's almost like you kind of have to just define them to be what they need to be in order to make the equation true. So that's, in particular, that's true for V. So let me just make sure you get this point, that Rothbard says that as bad as the P and the T are, the V is worse than the others. So let me explain the V thing first, and then I'll come back and explain why P and T are bad. So what Rothbard means here is, let's go back for a second. In this equation, MV equals PT, M, all right, we can define that. We know what that is. P, the price level, I mean, there are lots of problems with that, and we'll come back to the problems, but at least it's an independent thing that's out there. Okay, that kind of makes sense. And T, the number of transactions, all right. But he's saying this V, you... even to define that, you have to already, you know, look at the period in question. I mean, so it's not that that's some attribute of money to say how many times does it change hands. You know what I mean? That's in terms of some independent causal thing that we're trying to pull in and describe what's happening. Rothbard's saying that V really is qualitatively worse than these other things. Now what's the problem with the P and the T? Well, here Rothbard says, okay, when it comes to an individual commodity like potatoes, we just saw it would be silly to try to explain the price of potatoes using this approach. Incidentally, in case you haven't read the chapter yet, I'm making up the stuff with the analogy with potatoes. All right, Rothbard didn't do that in particular. I'm just trying to illustrate his arguments. He's saying, okay, so you can see methodologically it would be fruitless. You're not adding any information. All you're doing is thinking about it in the wrong way. You're throwing out all the progress economics has made since the marginal subjectivist revolution if you try to explain economic phenomena with this kind of macro holistic equation that doesn't rely on individual valuations at all. It just looks at aggregate statistics and comes up with tautologies relating them to each other. But at least the tautology is true for one commodity. So, yeah, it doesn't really help you. It's misleading, blah, 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 blah. But, okay, at least it's true and coherent to say for one commodity, MV equals PT. But then Rothbard says, but when you move beyond that and you try to aggregate it across multiple commodities, now it's not even clear that these things even make any sense. So for P, yeah, we can talk about the price of potatoes. That makes sense. But then when you say, oh, we don't just mean potatoes. We want to say the prices of all the goods in the economy. What's the average price? Well, here now that doesn't make any sense because to take an average, you have to have a common unit. And you might think, well, isn't it dollars or isn't it ounces of gold? No, because a price is a ratio. So, you know, the price of a hat, you might think, oh, isn't that $10? Well, no, but it's $10 per hat. And with gasoline, it's whatever, $3 per gallon, right? So if gasoline, you might think, oh, the gasoline was $3 and the hat $10, so the average of those, if you weighed it equally, is 13 divided by 2. But no, because you throw out the units. It's $10 per hat and $3 per gallon. And so if you tried to average those together, you'd get, if you want to do like the least common denominator, if you remember from your math classes when you were little, like if you have different fractions, how do you add them together? If the denominators are different, you can't just add the numerators and forget that the denominators were there. You have to, you know, multiply them together or do something like that. Okay, so incidentally, in case you were getting a little bit mixed up, that's what Rothbard is doing in Man, Economy, and State in this section, when he's taking those fractions and putting them together and having denominators like that have like hat in parentheses times something else in parentheses, I forget what. That's what he was doing. If you just totally didn't even get what he was doing there, just remind yourself, like, what would it be to say what's 3/7 plus, you know, 1/8, and how do you do that? Well, you turn them both into 56, right? And then you add up the numerator, and then that divided by 56, because really what you're doing is multiplying the 7 times the 8. And so that's what he's doing there. But 7 times 8, we know what that is. It's 56, but you can't do that with, a hat times an orange. We can't just put it in, oh, what's that? You have to just keep it as hat times orange or whatever goods he was using. So that's what he's doing there in case you got confused. All right, so the big picture here is in this equation of exchange, when the P, when we just say loosely, oh, at the average price level or the average price of a good, that doesn't mean, what the heck does that mean? You mean the average price. That's nonsense. So you can, later on we'll talk about index numbers and things and what they do to come up with something in practice, but you'll see it's arbitrary. And the concept is a lot more convoluted than you think at first. And then the same thing here too with this, with the total number of transactions, or down here the Q, the units, I think it's easier to picture with the Q, that when we say, oh, what's the total amount of real output? Because, you know, that's the way they use it here. Like they'll say, yeah, you've got your M times your V, and so if M goes way up, you know, chances are P is going to double and Q is not going to go up any. You know, but maybe, oh, if M goes up, then maybe P goes up a little bit and Q goes up a little bit too, so we get some more. People are talking there as if it makes sense to talk about some number to be real output. And Robert's point is, what are you talking about? The real output, okay, so you can say one configuration, the economy produced 1 million oranges, 500,000 apples, 62 cars, and 7 TV sets, and then in some other configuration, have some of those numbers be lower and some be higher. And then I ask which economy had more real output. And it's very difficult to answer that question. It's not an engineering question. You need to say, you have to come up with some way to weight the different units. You need to know, well, when we add it up into units of real output, a car should count as what? 100 times as much as an orange. So the way they do it in practice is they do it by the dollar amounts. And they say, well, if a car is $10,000 and an orange is, a pound of oranges is $1, then the car counts 10,000 times as much as a pound of oranges. Okay, but again, that's Robert's point there is, see what we're doing? We're treating this P and Q as if they're separate things, and then, oh, when we multiply them together, we get some new thing. And his point is that, no, you can only define Q to be total expenditures divided by P. So it's misleading. It's giving us this false sense of precision and accuracy and being scientific when we write P times Q, because this Q is not this independent thing, really. It's all we mean by Q is MV divided by P. That's really what the definition of Q is. So all we're really doing is writing MV equals MV, and we're fooling ourselves if we think we're relating it to something independent, namely P times Q. Okay, well, we'll spend a lot of time on that. Let's move on here. A big concept that Rothbard hammers throughout this chapter, or this section of the chapter, is that money is not a yardstick of value. And that's really, and this, if you are particularly nerdy and like this stuff, go ahead and look at my study guide to the theory of money and credit. Because Mises spends a lot of time on this early on in the theory of money and credit. and this all goes back to Irving Fisher. So I should have mentioned that. Irving Fisher is one of the guys that really, I don't think he invented this equation. Maybe, I don't know, he probably didn't. But he certainly was an economist who made a lot of it and brought to everyone's attention. Irving Fisher being a hugely influential economist, one of the sort of the original godfathers of what we now consider to be the Chicago School. Milton Friedman revered Irving Fisher. And he's probably like the father of monetarism more than Milton Friedman is. So anyway, amongst his other attributes, one of Fisher's things was he wanted to have a stable money, a money that had a stable purchasing power. And Mises goes through, Rothbard touches on it a little bit, but Mises does it more in depth in Theory of Money and Credit, just going through Fisher's proposals for how, at least in principle, could we measure the purchasing power of money and how could we stabilize and that sort of thing. And part of the problem here is that, as Mises points out and Rothbard does too, that Fisher and the people in that tradition, they're misconceiving what economic value is. That value is not some objective thing that can be measured the way you can measure length or weight or mass. That, oh, how long is something? How do you measure it? Well, you take a yardstick and you keep laying it end to end. And so you say, you know, what does it mean to say that thing is 10 yards long? Well, length is an objective property or attribute of something, and I can take this other thing that's objectively 1 yard long, just, you know, we define it as 1 yard, and then we're saying this other thing is 10 times as long as this thing. Or I could take the yardstick and lay it end to end 10 times, and I've just measured the length of the other thing. So a lot of economists believe that money is the measuring rod when it comes to economic value. And they think that, oh, if something costs, if this thing over here costs $100, and this thing over here, or I should say, this thing has a price of $100, and this thing over here has a price of 10, that the first thing has 10 times as much economic value, and that's why it takes $100 bills end to end, so to speak, to equal the value of that thing, whereas it only takes 10 to equal the value of this other thing. And so whatever value is, there's 10 times as much of it in the first thing as in the second thing. That's the mentality. And then they admit or they understand that it's a little bit weird because if money is a yardstick, it's a yardstick that shrinks or expands over time. So what was a yard in 1913 is different from what a yard is today, like clearly so. And so, you got to take that into account, that the yardstick moves. And wouldn't it be good then if we had a stable yardstick just like we have in physics? So this is totally wrong, Mises thinks. He's got this neat, I don't know if this is an exact quote, but he says something like this, that look, prices aren't measured in money, they consist in money. And so what he's trying to hammer home there is that there's money is not measuring the price of something. It's not that the price is some abstract thing out there, and then the money is just our way of quantifying that abstract thing. The way that length is this intrinsic property, and then a yard is the unit by which, or a meter, is the unit by which we quantify it. The Mises is saying, no, there's nothing deeper involved. When you trade $10 bills for that, whatever, CD, it's the price is the $10. That's what the price, I mean, that's what it means. It's like, what's the price of that? It's saying how much of the money commodity do you have to give up to get that thing? That's what it means. It's not that, it, for sure what it's not is to say, there's some equality of value, and then when you exchange things of equal value. That's clearly not what's going on. When you buy something for $10, the buyer values the item, the CD, more than the $10. That's why he made the trade. And the seller values the $10 more than the CD. That's why he made the trade. So any particular transaction involves differences in valuation, not in the quality. The only thing that you could say is equal is market value. So there it's true that if something over here has a price of $100 and something over here has a price of $10, you could say the market value of the first thing is 10 times the second thing. But when you inquire and say, what do you mean by market value? It's not some thing that's out there the way mass is kind of like we think it's some objective property. What we mean by market value is simply if you sold it, how many units of money would you get for it? All right, so that's a subtle point, but it's pretty important. Just keep that in mind that for Mises and Rothbard and the people in that tradition, it's not that when we buy something with money, that's somehow measuring how much value that thing has. It's more that it's either not measuring anything at all, or it's just indicating the market value of the thing. It's certainly not the subjective value. So there's it's awkward that term value has different connotations. So it's probably safer just to talk about wealth. And I can say objectively, this man has more material wealth or financial wealth than this person over here. And you can say, well, what do you mean by that? And I can say, well, I mean, if he sold all of his assets and paid off all his debts, he would have more money than this other guy. That's what I mean when I say this guy is financially wealthier. Right? I don't mean like, oh, he's got a nice family and he's healthy, and so in a sense he's wealthier than this billionaire who is miserable. I'm saying wealth in the financial sense. So you could talk like that if you wanted to, but again, it's ultimately, you know, what do you mean? Whereas with length, I suppose certain people in physics might really push it, especially like in quantum physics and so on. But I mean, in conventional everyday terminology and how people normally think of it, you think that some object's length is some objective thing about the object. You don't think that length only means if I lay a yardstick against it, how many times can I do it, and that the yards, you know, you would never say the train's length consists in how many yardsticks I have to put side by side next to it. That would seem kind of weird to talk about that. No, you'd say, no, the yardstick is measuring the length. The length is that objective principle or property that's out there. All right, so now on the heels of that sort of deep philosophical tangent, let's talk about some of the specific problems with this idea of stabilization. So here, Rothbard, again, his target is Irving Fisher, but that's only because Fisher was the godfather of this discipline or this goal, that plenty of people do this as well. It's just Fisher was the person who did a lot of work discussing the theoretical virtues, alleged theoretical virtues, of stabilizing the purchasing power of money, and also developed a lot of techniques for computing index numbers. So that brings me to the first point I want to talk about. Something that Mises and Rothbard talk about repeatedly in their works is that the purchasing power of money is an important concept when we're trying to discuss the formation of money prices and we want to apply economic theory to money. But remember, strictly speaking, the purchasing power of money is an array. It's not a single number. And again, that's because money, unique among other among all the commodities, money is the good that in every transaction, or just about every transaction, serves on one side of it. So during the course of a year, maybe nobody ever trades potatoes for television sets. That probably never happens, ever. and nobody ever sells his labor to obtain shares of Google stock, probably, I'm guessing. That particular transaction doesn't happen. But every good and service, at least if you define them broadly enough, so it's not some really particular thing, every good or service trades against money all the time. And so that's just why when we report, you know, what's the price of a potato, it's perfectly fine to say just a single number. Oh, it's whatever, 20 cents per pound. You don't have to list, you know, the person doesn't say, okay, that's how much potatoes trade against U.S. currency, but what if I wanted to trade a potato against a TV set? What's my ratio or exchange rate there? That would be goofy because nobody does that. That's irrelevant. But with money, it would be weird to say, hey, what's the purchasing power of money? And you say, oh, with $1, you can get 5 pounds of potatoes, period. Then you walk away thinking you answered the question. The person would hunt you down and say, whoa, 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 I need a lot more information than that. There's lots of things that money can buy. Give me lots of different numbers. Sure, I can, with $1, I can get 5 pounds of potatoes, but how many how many Ferraris can I get? How many television sets can I get? How many houses in this neighborhood with this square footage can I get? And so on. And so, again, I'm just pointing out, you know, why is it that with the potatoes, we feel like we've answered the question to just give one number, but with money we haven't. It's just because of the nature of what money is. In practice, money is the thing that serves in just about every transaction or every exchange. So, given that, then, when you want to talk about the purchasing power of money beyond just the abstract concept of it and actually use it for something, like if you want to, for example, tell the Federal Reserve you need to stabilize the purchasing power of money, well, you can't tell the Fed to hold all prices constant, because then, you know, there would be no adjustments, right? I mean, so that would be the only non-arbitrary way to ensure a stable purchasing power of money, is if all prices had to stay the same forever. So today, potatoes are 20 cents a pound. They have to stay 20 cents a pound forever. And right now, gasoline is $3.29 per gallon. It's got to stay that exact number forever. And that would be the only way you could be sure you had stabilized the purchasing power of money. So clearly, that would be crazy. That, you know, you'd have all kinds of black markets because the market, you know, the market clearing price in individual markets would change. And if the price weren't allowed to change, then you'd either have shortages or surpluses all over the place. So what people mean in practice and what Fisher meant was, okay, we come up with an index. So obviously some prices are going to go up, some prices are going to go down. When I say maintain a stable dollar, what I mean is, in general, the average purchasing power of this thing stays constant over time. So if some prices are going up, it better be the case that some are going down. Okay, so now we get into the issue of constructing an index. And then you have to figure out, so you might say, okay, what I care about is what the average household has to buy for the so-called, you know, costs of living. That's what I mean. When I say stabilize the purchasing power of money, just think about it. In general, and this also goes back to this issue. Let me just flip back for a second here. Oops, too much. This issue here, the difference between MV equals PT versus MV equals PQ. Keep in mind, if this T really includes all transactions, it also means when people buy corporate stock. But that's, you know, if I pay $1,000 to get some shares of Xerox or something, just about, you know, certainly Scott Sumner doesn't have that in mind when he's thinking of maintaining nominal GDP. So it's just not true. Right now when people talk about total spending in the economy, they're relying on their macro training and to just net out all that stuff. Most people, economists, I would say nowadays, when they talk about total spending, it doesn't even occur to them that, well, in fact, if you spend $1,000 buying corporate stock from, you know, just some other person who's selling it to you in the secondary market, not a new issue, but just some guy who bought it last year, he wants to get rid of it, he sells it to you for $1,000, that's spending. There's money changing hands. That's part of the velocity of circulation of those dollars. But most people, you know, most economists don't even think of that when they're talking about N times V. So, and then also too, when people are talking about stabilizing the purchasing power of money, most economists, it wouldn't even occur to them that you would put stock prices into your index. So when people say, hey, has there been price inflation? Most economists wouldn't think to put in the price of corporate stock and say, oh, yeah, the dollar's really gotten a lot weaker. No, economists usually think, oh, that's awesome. The stock market's booming. That's great. And so when they say, what do you mean, isn't that a weak dollar? They say, no, because the average consumer, when he goes to the store, can still buy milk and eggs and bread and gasoline and, you know, maybe heat for his house at prices that are comparable to last year. Maybe they only went up by a couple percentage points. So in terms of the cost of living, consumers are still fine and workers are still fine with their normal paychecks. And these asset prices that went up, that's just reflecting a healthy economy. Right, so that kind of mentality, I'm just showing you what underlies that is the idea that to talk about the purchasing power of money, in practice, people have some basket of commodities in mind or some index. So Mises and Rothbard, their point is the construction of these things is arbitrary. And it's not even nefarious. So, of course, I'm sure a lot of you guys know the jokes about the Fed and or the Bureau of Labor Statistics and how they come up with these crazy inflation numbers, you know, netting out food and energy prices and calling that core inflation, all that kind of stuff. But even if it weren't nefarious, even if you had two honest economists who weren't in the pay of the government or in the pay of John Williams, the shadow staff, you know, they had no agenda, and they were truly just trying to say, this is objectively, scientifically, what I think the best measurement is of the purchasing power of money for the purpose of, let's say, stabilizing it or tracking over time how much does it cost to maintain a middle-class lifestyle in St. Louis. You know, even if we were that specific about it, those economists would come up with different numbers. Maybe for a while they'd be close, but over time they would just drift from each other in ways that if two different physicists wanted to measure the charge on an electron, presumably over time their estimates would get fairly close to each other. So, and the point is just because there is no objective measure of what the purchasing power of money is besides just listing all the, you know, the array of every possible good and service. I don't want to take too much time on this, but let me just give you some of the issues here. For one thing, there's the issue of quality differences. So, for example, surely nowadays, a modern household, you know, what's the cost of living? You've got to include having your cell phone and having internet and having a computer. I mean, those things are pretty standard now, for especially if you mean like a middle-class U.S. household. And so how do you gauge that? You could look at, oh, my gosh, my Comcast bill goes up on average 5% every year or something like that, but the service you're getting from them gets better and better too, right? The kind of stuff that I can download and, you know, I can watch movies now and everything. I mean, the internet service that I get now is just almost incomparably better than what I got 10 years ago. So it would be pessimistic. It would be if I just naively plugged in the number of, you know, how many dollars did I have to spend back then, how many dollars do I have to spend now, and then presumably it would be higher. I know it would be higher. I don't know by how much. And then say, oh, that's the inflation of the price of or weakening of the purchasing power of the dollar with respect to internet service, that would be totally wrong. a dollar now buys a lot more internet service than it did 10 years ago, just like a dollar buys a heck of a lot more computing power now than it did 10 years ago, even if the price of a baseline machine might be higher or low. I don't know off the top of my head than it was 10 years ago, because you're just getting laptops now that have so much more memory and everything else compared to what you would have bought 10 years ago. All right, so that's just one of these issues with this stuff. Okay, another problem Rothbard brings up is that to the extent that the changes in the purchasing power of money originate in the marketplace, why do we want to counteract that? So let's say we're just humming along, and then all of a sudden everybody wants to hold higher cash balances. So we know if the government or the Fed didn't intervene, what would happen? Well, each individual on the margin would all of a sudden value cash more highly than the other alternatives, you know, things you could get with it. So people would, in a sense, try to spend less. They try to hoard money. Collectively, that can't happen if there's no more money available than the existing stock. And so what that means is all of a sudden there would be excess supplies of all their goods, and so their market clearing price would fall. Or another way of putting it is everybody's demand for other goods and services would shift to the left as they're, you know, hoarding money. And so that would cause the market price of everything else quoted in money to go down until the point at which the existing stock of money hit now the lower prices, means the purchasing power of it has gone up enough such that not everyone's holding the desired real balances, or the desired amount of purchasing power in their cash balances. So there, what happened is the purchasing power of money went up. It wasn't stable. And Rothbard says, so what? Why would we want to come in and counteract what people are trying to do? If people want to hold higher cash balances, by all means, let the purchasing power of money go up, so now people are holding higher cash balances measured in real terms. So that's his point. Now, let me just do a little nitpick, or not nitpick, but just what somebody who disagrees with Rothbard would say there. If you just look at those passages, Rothbard makes it sound like if Irving Fisher were on the scene and we were following his crazy advice and people all of a sudden wanted to hold more cash balances or higher cash balances, that Fisher would somehow prevent them from achieving their objectives. Because Rothbard's thinking the purchasing, left to the market's own devices, the purchasing power of money would go up, so now everyone's happy again. But Fisher won't let the purchasing power of money go up, that jerk, and so now everyone's frustrated. But that's not quite right, or that's not the whole story. How would Irving Fisher keep the purchasing power of money from going up? He would pump in more money, right? He would say, oh my gosh, because from Fisher's point of view, it would be, oh gee, prices of goods in dollars are falling. Uh-oh, we've got deflation going on. I want to maintain the purchasing power of money, so what do? I pump in more dollars to get the prices to go back up to where I want them to be, or at least to stop them from falling. So people do get to hold more cash balances. It's just the adjustment mechanism isn't a fixed stock of money with prices falling. It's rather fixed prices with the stock of money increasing until now everyone's holding what they want. Right, so that's, obviously I'm not endorsing Fisher's proposal. I'm just saying Rothbard's critique made it sound like if we listen to that nut job Fisher and people all of a sudden wanted to hold more cash, they wouldn't be able to, that there wouldn't be an equilibration process, and that's not quite right. Okay, another thing is that, let me also just mention one other thing. This is why, incidentally, if you've heard of these group of Austrian, there's a group of people called the Free Bankers, and they are affiliated with the Austrians. There's a lot of free bankers who call themselves Austrian economists, I don't know if there are free bankers who say they're not Austrians. Probably are. Anyway, that's what I just went through. That's one of their standard arguments. So these people, in case you don't know who they are against, typically, they are against fiat money in central banks, but they have no problem with fractional reserve banking. They just think it should be left to the private sector. All right, so again, they're generally in support of hard commodity money. So they like gold. They don't want fiat dollars or anything like that. But they have no problem as long as there's no government support, no FDIC, no central bank ready to bail them out, voluntary contracts with all their customers, no fraud, et cetera. They have no problem if a bank, if you deposit money into what you think is a checking account, demand deposit of gold, and then they go and lend 80% of that out to somebody else. The free bankers have no problem with that, just, again, so long as if a bank gets caught violating its contractual obligations, it's as legally liable as any other business that defrauds its customers or doesn't fulfill its contract. So one of the main arguments they use for why their system makes more sense than the Rothbardian approach, where, yeah, of course, we have no fiat money, we have no central bank, but Rothbard goes further and says, even in the pure market economy, there's no fractional reserve banking. That Rothbard thinks that is inherently fraudulent, and so by definition, that doesn't happen in a free society where property rights are respected. So the free bankers will say, oh, Rothbard, yeah, your system's better than what we got now, but our system's even better than yours, because in our system, where we do allow private sector banks to, in a sense, create money out of thin air, we can deal more efficiently with increases in the demand to hold money. That in our, with your system, Rothbard, if all of a sudden, for some reason, the public wants to hold twice as much gold, then what has to happen? Well, first of all, people go out and start digging up more gold, and that wastes resources. You know, there's labor and other digging equipment and stuff that's being used to extract more yellow metal that's just going to go sit in a bank vault somewhere, sit in somebody's purse. That's kind of stupid. And then beyond that, if part of the adjustment is through falling prices, well, that screws up things because people made debt contracts, blah, 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 and wages might be sticky, and, you know, so that's sort of a painful adjustment process that also wastes resources, digging up more gold, whereas wouldn't it be so much better if, oh, the public wants to hold more gold? What do? We just have our fractional reserve private sector banking system print up a bunch of more tickets saying the bearer of this note will get 1 ounce of gold from Acme Bank, and Acme Bank just prints up more of those tickets and hands them out to people, and that satisfies their desire. You know, any individual household can think this ticket is fully redeemable on demand, even though if everyone did it at once, it wouldn't work. So what? Everybody can think that he's got this much gold at his command now, and we didn't have to waste resources digging it up, and we didn't have to have prices quoted in gold fall 5%, screwing up everything. So isn't this great? All right, so anyway, that's just a little digression there, but that's what the free bankers would say. In general, now this third point on the slide, Austrians don't like the term price level. I've been trying to catch myself. It's hard, especially if you're just explaining the mainstream view, it's hard to avoid slipping and saying price level, but Austrians don't like it since it obscures the non-neutrality of money. The very term price level, if I go back here, makes you think like this. Makes you think that, oh, there's an N times a V, and then that changes the price level, which is like the average level of prices or the average price. And like I say, we want to say that, no, that doesn't work. And it's downright harmful to think like that because it makes you think that, oh, well, if the Fed doubles the quantity of money, what will it do to the price level versus what will it do to real output? And Austrians want to say, whoa. It's, all prices are not going to be affected uniformly. Some prices may go up 4 times. Some prices might go up 20%. And they're not going to do it at the same time either. There's going to be a rippling out effect that where the money hits first, those prices will start rising, and then as those people get their hands on more and more money, they're going to start spending more, pushing up the prices of the stuff that they buy, and it will ripple out. And that if you just focus on the price level, you're going to totally miss that. And this is partly why, I mean, it's really astounding that there are these people wanting to target nominal GDP and so on and saying, oh, the Fed needs to inflate more to boost aggregate demand, and what this economy needs is a little bit more price inflation, blah, blah, blah. And it makes a big difference if you're a household right now struggling. It makes a big difference if the Fed takes $1 trillion and just sprinkles it out uniformly and everybody gets an extra $1,000 versus if the Fed gives $1 trillion to Citibank. But the way these people, their models work, there is no distinction there because all they have in the model is what's M, what's V, what's P, what's Q. And so they say, oh yeah, that's why we need more quantitative easing, and it doesn't matter how the Fed actually gets the money into the economy. But of course, if you're an average household, you're not helped by the fact that all of a sudden prices go up 10% and your wages haven't gone up. This slide I wanted to just show you, this was kind of a, I don't know if it was famous, but in Austrian lore, when we talk about what's wrong with stabilization, one of the key aha things, or you know, the key sagas that we now, singing the praises of Mises and Hayek, we look back at when they grappled with the gladiators from other schools of thought, is that in the 1920s, Irving Fisher famously gave a clean bill of health to the U.S. economy. In fact, I mean, he's got some outrageously bad predictions where like a month or two before the stock market crash in 1929, he says, I don't remember the exact quote, something like, stocks have reached a permanently high plateau. You know, so Fisher has some amazingly bad predictions in 1928 and even 1929, I believe, of how healthy the U.S. economy is, when, of course, it was just getting ready to fall off a cliff. And so he also has more specific statements saying, you know, praising the Federal Reserve of the U.S. Again, I don't remember the exact quotes, but to the effect that no other central bank has most put my ideas of stabilization policy into practice as the Federal Reserve has during the 1920s. Again, don't quote me, that's not an exact quote, but words to that effect. And you can see where he's coming from. So this is the Consumer Price Index. You can see here, this was, you know, the tail end of World War I. Annual price inflation was about 21% at this point. The Fed jacked up interest rates, shrank the base and so on. Price inflation fell way back down. Or prices fell down, so I mean, it was price deflation. So this is the level of consumer prices. So I misspoke there. When I said price inflation was 21%, I was reading the chart wrong. This chart is measuring the level of the CPI. So these are not inflation rates. This is just the level of prices, if you will, if level of prices meant something. Level of consumer prices. So you see consumer prices fell way down. But then throughout the 20s, they're basically constant. Yeah, I mean, they rose a little bit here. They actually fell gently. So this is kind of funny when people worry about deflation, by which they mean price deflation, and how awful it would be. And, oh, my gosh, Bernanke, he has to make sure we have a buffer there. You know, we need to have a good 1.5% to 2% core inflation, because if we ever got to that awful point where consumers actually thought prices were going to start falling, then it would set in motion a vicious downward spiral where nobody would buy anything because it was going to be cheaper in 3 months. But then that would make prices fall even more, so then nobody would buy anything because prices were going to be – and we would just fall into depression. Well, that's kind of funny, since – from 1925 to 1929, you can see prices did gently fall in the U.S. And I don't remember people during the 1920s thinking they were in a depression. No, those were the roaring 20s. There was a boom going on here, even though consumer prices were gently falling in the latter half of this decade. So my point here with this slide is that part of why Irving Fisher thought the Fed was doing a bang-up job is that you didn't see soaring inflation, right? So everybody here would agree, oh, yeah, during the war, the Federal Reserve was monetizing Uncle Sam's debts. The debt of the U.S. went way up during World War One, right? The government spent a lot of money on armaments that it wasn't taking in tax revenue, so the official public debt of the U.S. government went way up under World War One, and they partly, I don't want to say they financed it because that's misleading. The Fed absorbed a lot of that, and so you could see that in terms of rising prices. But at that, but it looks like the Fed's doing a pretty good job. And so that's partly why Irving Fisher thought the Fed was doing fine. So the Austrians, Mises and Hayek, and I've done some research on this, by the way. We like to say, oh, Mises and Hayek predicted the stock market crash. I mean, somebody could fairly object to that and say that's a little bit giving us too much credit. But for sure, Mises and Hayek knew there was a credit bubble going on in the late 20s in the United States. Okay, so it's not like they said in the last quarter of 1929 we're going to see a 20% drop in the Dow Jones. I don't think they ever said something that specific. But they knew there was a credit bubble going on, even though these prices, consumer prices, were gently falling. And so that just, you know, shows that the Austrian approach, seeing the shortcomings of what Irving Fisher was doing, saw this problem brewing, whereas these macro models that lump stuff together and only look at certain sectors and didn't look at asset prices, that lulled people into a false sense of security, and then they didn't see the crash coming. So, I mean, what's funny is guys like Scott Sumner, people who right now think Bernanke needs to print more money, his explanation for this, and also Milton Friedman's, is that, yeah, the Fed was doing a good job. There was nothing unsustainable about the stock market bubble that formed in the late 20s. What happened is the Fed stupidly started getting too tight in 29, and the Fed caused this to happen. And then the Fed really stupidly allowed prices to plummet in the early 30s by letting the quantity of money shrink, because there were all the bank runs and everything. So the monetarists, people like Milton Friedman and their modern disciples, they look at this and they say, Irving Fisher was right. The economy was great. It was just the Fed then changed policies and stupidly started being contractionary when it should have been expanding. Okay, let me go through this really fast, because I want to focus on the Keynesian stuff at the end. Rothbard here, just to clarify for you his scope of attack and his classification scheme, you might think that, oh, Rothbard now just dealt with the business cycle. And that's actually not what he did here. He is giving you the stylized facts of business cycles, what it is that a business cycle theory has to explain. But in Chapter 11, Rothbard hasn't given it to you, because remember, for Rothbard, chapters 1 through 11 of Man, Economy, and State deal with the pure market economy. In Rothbard things, you cannot get what we mean by a business cycle in a pure market economy. So he allows himself to critique Schumpeter and his theory of the business cycle, because Schumpeter thought the business cycle was an outgrowth of the pure market economy. Schumpeter was trying to show how in a pure market economy, a business cycle could arise. So that's why Rothbard is critiquing that, since, you know, we're still in the section of dealing with the pure market. And, oh, somebody has a bad theory talking about the pure market economy, so now here's the place where Rothbard's going to blow that up. But Rothbard doesn't here give his own theory as to what it is, because he thinks it's due to government intervention. So that's why what we think of as the Austrian theory of the business cycle, Rothbard's going to lay out in Chapter 12. But here, Rothbard does give us a little hint and say, okay, if you're going to try to explain the business cycle, first of all, I actually don't have this bullet point here. I forgot to put it in. one thing is the business cycle has not been with us through all of human history. There were economic calamities going back as far as history goes, but those were all attributable to some specific disaster, like if there was a crop failure or, you know, locusts or a war or whatever, a really bad winter or something, you could explain why that economy was devastated, if you want to talk like that. But what we mean by the business cycle, where it seems like there's this recurring cyclical pattern of apparent prosperity where everything's doing great, and then it just, the bottom falls out, and you get high unemployment and so on. He's saying that is a relatively recent phenomenon. I think he says it starts like in the late 17th century, or maybe the late 1700s. I'm getting mixed up as to whether it was the century or the hundreds. Maybe the late 1700s and then 1800s is when you really see it kicking in. Other stylized facts about, you know, what is it that a business cycle theory has to explain, that the boom period, it doesn't hit all sectors evenly, that the boom is concentrated in the capital goods sectors. So yeah, retailers, their business picks up during the boom, but not like what we would call the higher order goods, that the people who are, you know, the oil refiners and the people who are selling steel and those kinds of things, the people making tractors, they see their business go up more than the people selling coffee to consumers see their business go up during the boom. There's also typically a general increase in prices during the boom and then a drop. Since countries have gone off the gold standard, this is more given way to the rate of price inflation is higher during the boom and lower during the bust. But it used to be historically prices went up during the boom and then actually went down during the bust, whereas now there's just a general upswing in prices so that the cyclical up and down is still, you know, it's around a moving, a general upward trend. So that you might not actually get falling prices per se during the bust. You might just get a temporary drop in prices. Or sorry, a slowdown in the rate of price increase. You have this apparent prosperity that all of a sudden gives way to excess capacity, including in the labor market, which we call unemployment. And then the last thing that Rothbard points out is there's a cluster of errors. So it's not merely these other statistical things I can talk about. There's also the fact that for some reason, time and again, it seems like the majority of business people are stupid at the same time. So normally, at any given period, of course, some firms go bankrupt. Some people start ventures. It turns out there's no demand for it, or the costs are too high, and they got to close down. But what happens in the business cycle is there's this, you know, when the bust, and it's like all kinds of people slap their heads and say, "What the heck were we thinking?" And so that's the issue. So it's not, the question is not why is it that sometimes a business fails. The question is why does there seem to be these cycles where the failure is coordinated or synchronized? Why does that seem to happen in this rhythmic fashion? So that's what you have to explain. Like I say, Rothbard thinks Schumpeter didn't explain it, and Rothbard will try to explain it in Chapter 12. Okay, last two slides here. I want to just walk you through, or three slides, but I broke up the last two points. So Rothbard goes through the Keynesian multiplier. So this is one of my favorite things that he does in the book. So he says, okay, what he's doing here, this is the old school Keynesian way of trying to show that if the government spends more money, that will boost GDP by more than the expenditure. So you still, to this day, you hear Keynesians arguing about what's the multiplier on government spending. And so nowadays, the Keynesians would use a different argument to try to establish the existence of this multiplier. But I think Robert is being fair. I think the Keynesians of his, because remember, Man Economy and State came out in what, like 62? So I think Rothbard wrote it during the late 50s. And, you know, this is the sort of thing that the Keynesians would use at the time to get the idea across. So here's what the Keynesians might say. They say, okay, look, social income is equal to consumption plus investment. Right now we're not worried about talking about government versus private sector. Now, assume that consumption is 0.8 times income, and we can statistically look back and see that, yeah, on average, that's about right. So now what I'm going to do is take this equation up here and just plug in this thing for consumption. So now I've got income still on the left side. Instead of this consumption, now I'm just going to write 0.8 times income because I know that consumption equals 0.8 times income plus investment. Now I just do algebra. Subtract this 0.8 of income from this from both sides, so I'm left with 0.2 times income equals investment. Divide by 0.2, so I get total income equals 5 times investment. And so now the Keynesians will say, oh, see, the multiplier on investment spending is 5. So if we could just get, you know, if businesses would be willing to do it and they'd be willing to spend $100 billion more, then total income in the economy would go up by $500 billion. And if business won't do it because they're afraid of the future, they got excess capacity, whatever, interest rates are already at zero. If the government comes in and spends $100 billion on bridges and roads, that will raise GDP by $500 billion. So the point is you're getting a lot of bang for your buck. So what kind of fool would turn down all the benefits of government spending when you're in a downturn when it's going to, on the margin, bring you so much more fruit? So Rothbard wants to say that's crazy. That argument is silly. Watch, I'm going to use their same exact approach and come up with a conclusion that's clearly ludicrous. So Robert says, all right, social income equals the income of the reader of my book plus the income of everybody else. That's tautology. No one can argue with that equation. Now he says, we can look historically and do run regressions and look at the income of of everybody else, so everyone in the economy except for the person right now reading my book, and you know, run regressions, correlate that with total income of the whole economy, and they're going to be almost identical. And maybe we get this fact that the income of everyone else is equal to 0.99999 times social income. Okay. Now I just rewrite this top equation, which we know is true. Rewrite it, social income, but now instead of and then the equals income of the reader plus, instead of writing income of everybody else, I'm going to substitute with this equation, because we know income of everyone else historically tends to be 0.99999 times social income, so I just replace that. Now I just do algebra, divide through, and I get the equation that social income equals 100,000 times the income of the person reading my book right now. So, Rothbard says, if you think the government should spend some money buying bridges to boost investment because of the multiplier of 5, well, that's peanuts. Just give money to my reader, you know, pay him to sing you a song or recite a limerick, give him $1 million, and you get a multiplier of 100,000. You're going to raise GDP 100,000 times whatever you give to my reader. All right. So the point is, if you think through and say, whoa, clearly that can't be right. Something's screwy with this argument. And if you go through and put your finger on what's wrong with it, Rothbard can say, okay, great, now you know what's wrong with the standard Keynesian argument that allegedly establishes an investment multiplier. So to give you a hint, specifically what's wrong is this equation here, assuming that number is going to stay the same. So yeah, you can look back historically and say the income of this one guy tends to be 1/100,000th of the economy, and really they would only be true if there were 100,000 total workers who earn the same wage. In other words, the real number would be bigger. The real multiplier would be bigger, right? So, but if now all of a sudden the government runs a deficit or takes more in taxes and gives more income to that person, that's actually not going to raise total social income. That's going to, you know, reduce the income of other people and raise that guy's income. And so now, and if you did a really huge number, like if you took $1 billion from people and gave it to that guy, well, then this number would change. You know, next year, if you ran the regressions again, all of a sudden that number would be a lot different because of this huge change you made. So that's what's going on in this trick here, is that you're using historical statistics where there wasn't a massive government intervention to come up with this number, and then you're coming up with this equation thinking, okay, so in other words, this equation is true as far as it goes referring to the past, but there's no reason to assume that if you now increase the income of the reader, that the way this equation is going to be true is that social income is going to go up by 100,000 times that increment. Rather, what's going to happen is you boost the income of the reader, and then 100,000 will go down. All right, and the last thing for tonight, for the main launcher here, is I want to talk about this accelerator principle. So this, I think I've only heard of the accelerator principle when I read free market economists making fun of it. So I think this was so obliterated that even Keynesians don't bring this up anymore. That's my understanding. I mean, that's, I don't know that for sure. What I do know for sure is I've never heard a Keynesian talking about the accelerator, even though, you know, Rothbard quotes people, and I know that and I've read Hutt criticizing. So this isn't a straw man. Keynesians at one point in the 50s did use examples like this to try to get their point across, and I don't see them do that anymore. Like, I've never seen Krugman talk about the accelerator. But anyway, what was it? What the Keynesians were trying to do is they were trying to explain, you know, give some intuition as to why is it that, how could it be that the investment spending can have such a big multiplier? You know, why does investment seem to have such a kick to it? And this partly ties in with the Keynesian diagnosis of what happens in a recession. So the idea there is, oh, geez, spending falls, particularly in the investment sector, because investment's real volatile, and that can lead to the downturn. And then that's why the government needs to come in and fill the gap. And it doesn't need to fill the whole gap. It just needs to fill a little bit because there's this multiplier. So this accelerator story is part of that broad worldview to try to show, you know, gee, why is it? That seems kind of weird. How could it be that, you know, spending at the higher goods levels is amplified so much? So the idea that it runs something like this, and I don't know if I'm going to have the same numbers that Rothbard has, but the idea is, let's say there's a laundromat and it has 10 washing machines, you know, industrial strength washers where people come and put their clothes in, and the average lifespan of a machine like that is 10 years, right? So if the laundromat's business is constant, and they have, you know, and 10 is what they need to cater to their clients. So they have 10, in any given time, they have 10 units in existence. And let's say that, you know, they staggered it out. So every year, one machine needs to get replaced. And they just do that year after year. There's a new machine, or a machine that was 9 years old, now it's 10 years old, it gets replaced. Okay? So every year, they replace one machine. And equilibrium like that, long-run equilibrium. Now, there's a slight uptick in consumer demand, that now they get 10% more business. So for this year, the 10 washing machines is not enough, because they have 10% more customers. So they need to now carry 11 machines at any given time. So the accelerator story says, ah, look at what happens. Even though the final demand increased 10%, the demand of the laundromat for the capital good, for the people whose business it is to sell new washing machines, doubled. Because normally this year they would just have bought one machine, But now this year they have to buy two machines because they have to increase their stock of washers up to 11 units. So they had 10, one wore away, so now they have 9, so they got to buy two this year to get to back to where they need to be. And so the point is, look at the acceleration going from the consumption to the investment side, that a 10% increase in demand for final services of laundromat services translates, gets amplified into a 100% increase in the purchases of these equipment. So there the Keynesians were trying to show why investment was so volatile, because, you know, a little upswing during the boom period by consumer spending translates into a huge magnification in investment spending. But then, of course, the other thing happens too, when consumer spending goes down just a little bit, all of a sudden there's a collapse in the on the investment side. So there's a couple things wrong with that story. So one thing that Rothbard points out is, how stupid would the people in the business of making washing machines have to be to not understand what was happening here, or certainly to keep being fooled business cycle after business cycle? You would think if that were the whole story, that it was just this issue of, you know, the timing element and so forth, the surely entrepreneurs would have replaced those people that didn't see that kind of thing coming. But more specifically, and this was a point that William Hutt brought out, is he said there's a trick in this story. The whole thing depends on the fact that we're using 1 year as our unit of time. And so that we're saying, oh, on a given year, one machine gets replaced on average, and so now in the new year, after the demand has gone up by 10% by the customers, the demand for washing machines doubles. But Hutt says, why are we using a year as the unit of time? What if we use 6 months? What if we used 1 month? And so the narrower we made the time frame, the bigger the amplification would be. It's a little bit hard to see, because if I'm only buying one washing machine per year, you know, so what that would mean is, if we looked at 1 week, normally we would be buying 1/52nd of a washing machine, but now we're buying one washing machine and 1/50, so we're buying 53/52nds of a washing machine. So you see, oh my gosh, the accelerator was 53 times. So it didn't just double, it went up by a factor of 53. Holy cow. And see, but if you shrink the interval like that to get a bigger and bigger amplification, you would realize, wait a minute, something's screwy. You know, this isn't economics. This is just some game I'm playing with time, units of time. And so it doesn't seem as weird to us when we pick a year, just because a year seems like the right time frame. But Hutt's point is, economically, what is there in the story to say that it should be a year? And in fact, the only non-arbitrary time period would be the service length or life of the washing machine, which is 10 years. And we would see, over a 10-year period, if demand from the final customers increases 10%, then the demand of the laundromat owner for washing machines also increases 10%. That normally, before, over a 10-year period, he would buy 10 machines. Now, over a 10-year period, he buys 11 machines. So it went up by 10%. So that's a really neat point that I just wanted to walk you through to make sure you got that. So again, the idea there is, the Keynesians were using that kind of story of the accelerator to try to show how it was that slight changes up or down in consumer spending could lead to really big volatile changes in the investment sector, and then also to show the importance of propping up consumer spending. But the story doesn't make any sense, the mechanism. Okay, let's stop there, and let me see. I could probably answer one question, and then we got to stop. So logging in. Oops. Hang on, sorry, I took you to the wrong screen. Oh, incidentally, if some of you were having trouble logging in the last few days to the Moodle site, hang on, I gotta remember what my password is. Okay, that worked. They have been, I don't know if the term is migrating, but they've been like separating the servers out from Mises.org and Moodle so that if one gets bogged down, it doesn't slow the other one down. And I think they're telling me that is done now. So it was a little bit screwy the last few days, but we think with our fingers crossed that should be done now. So you shouldn't have the trouble logging in anymore. Okay, we are on week 5. Okay. And there are questions here, but they're kind of long, so I'm trying to see if there's a short one I can just... Okay, here's a good one. So George Smith says, is there a difference in meaning between the value of money and the purchasing power of money? I've always thought of those phrases as equivalent. Thanks. Good question, George. And actually, Rothbard explicitly talks about that in this section of the book, and he agrees with you. He says that, no, there, the value of, you know, all we can mean by that is... by the purchasing power of money, all it means is the various prices of goods and services. There is no, you know, abstract value of money, at least that we could measure in the way that somebody like Irving Fisher wants to do, such that we could stabilize it the way we could stabilize the temperature in the room. Let me just make sure you guys get that important point. It's not that Mises and Rothbard aren't merely saying, in practice, the central bank's not going to have enough information, or the Fed's tools are inappropriate for achieving these alleged or these objectives. So you could say, for example, some guy takes out a lighter and then a bag of ice, and he says, I'm going to use these things and stabilize the temperature of this room at exactly 72 degrees. Because if it's too cold, I'm going to turn on the lighter. If it's too hot, I'm going to open up the bag of ice and spread the ice cubes around so that, you know, there's more surface area exposed to the air, and, you know, that'll lower the temperature. So you could say to the guy, you're nuts, that especially like when the sun comes up or whatever, or if the sun goes down, you're not going to be able to stabilize. This is a huge room. Those tools aren't going to work. But the temperature of the room is a coherent concept, and we could measure it in principle more or less accurately. When Rothbard and Mises complain about Fisher trying to stabilize the purchasing power of money, their critique is more fundamental. They are saying there's really no such thing as the purchasing power of money except the whole array of prices for various goods and services, and you wouldn't want to stabilize that. That would make the economy come to a crashing halt. And so what you think you're doing is nonsense. And strictly speaking, George, there is, I mean, people do have subjective value. So I can talk about an individual has valuations on his preference ranking and values the fifth tomato more than the third unit of money, let's say. And then that would explain why he acts a certain way in a particular exchange. So if that's what you mean by the value of money, okay, but that's not usually what most people mean by the phrase the value of money. So most people, when they talk about the value of money, mean its purchasing power. So if somebody says, oh, the value of the dollar went up, people mean prices in general went down, that a dollar can buy you more stuff. They probably don't mean subjectively people now attribute more significance on the margin to a dollar than to a tomato. Even though the two are, so the two are related, and this, again, this stuff gets complicated, and the term value has different connotations. So it is true that if money has a higher purchasing power, you subjectively are going to value a unit of money more, but your subjective valuation, remember, is not a cardinal thing. All right, one last point, too, let me just mention, I forgot to say during the main lecture, I wanted to. With all this stuff, it's, you know, Mises and Rothbard aren't being crazy. They understand that the purchasing power of the mark went down in Germany during the hyperinflation period, right? So it's not like they're going to say, well, we don't have, you know, any price index you give me is arbitrary, and so for all we know, the housewife now has a stronger mark than she did 2 years ago. They're not going to be crazy and say stuff like that. So they, you know, Mises will say you can come up with general historical understanding and give a rough idea, but his point is scientifically you can't really construct a meaningful index. And again, going back to the analogy I made with the guy trying to stabilize the temperature in the room, one of the possibilities you might say, like if we didn't have a thermometer, you might say to the guy, how are you going to stabilize the temperature? You don't even know what the temperature is. How do you know what it is? But there, the point isn't the temperature doesn't exist, or it's an incoherent concept, right? So there are those distinctions. Whereas with the idea of stabilizing the purchasing power, part of the problem the Austrians say is, even in principle, even if you had access to all kinds of information, whatever, just theoretically, what do you mean by the purchasing power? All right, well, we got to stop there. I will announce when your quiz is for this week already and when the office hours will be for Saturday. And other than that, just keep up with the reading, and we'll see you next week.